ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to PM. I'm Annie Guest, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. Tonight, China and Australia broach sensitive issues at the ASEAN summit in Malaysia. Also, the new age of drone warfare drives a surge in Australian defence exports. And residents in Werribee in Melbourne's far west come to terms with wild weather.
I was on my way home. My wife was here. My next door neighbour's backyard finished in my driveway. So, pretty full on.
First tonight, the Prime Minister has met with the Chinese Premier on the sidelines of the ASEAN summit in Malaysia. It came just a week after a Chinese fighter jet shot flares dangerously close to an Australian surveillance plane, and on the heels of Australia joining forces with the US on a critical minerals deal. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, comprised of 11 countries, is meeting in Kuala Lumpur, alongside the leaders of global powers such as the US, Japan, South Korea, Canada, and Brazil. The ABC's Global Affairs editor, Laura Tingle, is in Malaysia, from where she joined me earlier. Laura, we've heard of the ASEAN summit's early moment of levity with President Trump dancing and fist-pumping on the tarmac. Can you update us on today's high-level meetings between Australia and China?
Yes, Annie. Now that we've got the Trump roadshow out of Kuala Lumpur, everybody's focusing very much on bilateral meetings. The biggest one for Australia was between the Prime Minister and the Chinese Premier. A lot of focus, obviously, on what the Prime Minister would have to say to the Chinese Premier about that recent incident where flares were shot at RAAF aircraft. We might just have a listen to what the Prime Minister told journalists a short time ago about that.
Well, he heard the message very directly. I'm not here to report in on what meetings that I on what people say when I have meetings. I'm accountable for what I say, and I made the position directly clear that this was an incident of concern for Australia.
That's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese in Kuala Lumpur. And Laura, this meeting with the Chinese Premier has come only a week after the US and Australia signed that deal aimed at securing supply of critical minerals and rare earths. What do we know about how that was broached?
Look, I think the Chinese are still very much in that more in sorrow than anger stage of looking at the world, Annie, as in saying, oh, you know, if only everybody was as grown up as China was, brackets Donald Trump. So there's all the sort of rhetoric from the Chinese is all about Australia helping to keep the world stable. I suspect that the language suggests that the Chinese made it clear that they were probably wanting to know exactly what the terms of that agreement between Australia and the US was about strategic minerals, whether it was an exclusive one or not. But I don't think they're going to be in a position to really complain about it as such. So it is interesting, given that President Trump's heading off to have these crucial talks with the Chinese President, President Xi, in South Korea in a couple of days' time. And critical minerals and rare earths are at the centre, if you like, of the bargaining position of these two superpowers.
And Laura, this ASEAN marks the historic inclusion of Timor-Leste. What might this mean for the resource-rich country?
Well, we spoke to President Ramos Horta, the ABC did, in Kuala Lumpur a couple of days ago about this, and he was emphasising the importance of opening up a market of 700 million people to what's still one of the poorest countries in the world. He was saying that Timor-Leste has dramatically increased its infrastructure and improved its infrastructure so that it's in a position to trade more, but it still needs a lot of investment. And he's hoping that there'll be a big boost and a shift from that resource focus to a lot of tourism. So he's hoping that the link into ASEAN will really open up the sort of tourism trade, investment into more infrastructure that's needed in the country in the years ahead.
And Laura, what's next on the PM's agenda in Asia?
The PM's going to spend another day here in Kuala Lumpur doing bilateral meetings and also with a lot of the ASEAN countries who are here, and also talking further to Malaysia, which is a pretty key partner. And he will then move on directly to Korea while President Trump's spending a day in Tokyo tomorrow. So he'll go there and be looking for further talks within the context of APEC as opposed to ASEAN, which of course is a bigger grouping with slightly different economic interests.
Global Affairs Editor Laura Tingle speaking from Malaysia. What's driving the extreme weather events across the country? A tornado in Melbourne, severe storms in southeast Queensland, snow in Hobart, heat waves in northern Australia, and last week record temperatures in both Queensland and New South Wales. So is this normal or is it linked to climate change? Bridget Fitzgerald takes a look.
On this normally quiet street in Werribee in Melbourne's southwest, workmen repair fallen power lines as residents pick through collapsed fences and uprooted trees. Locals here can't quite believe they were hit by a tornado.
I didn't even think they existed in our part of Australia, but here they are.
This resident, Adam, watched as the storm set in and the wind suddenly sped up and changed direction, twisting trees and sending objects flying into the air.
Where we are, we're right in the eye of it, and it lifted things up right up into the air and over the tops of houses. It sucked them up.
His house was largely spared, but his backyard is covered in debris, including a large tree that was ripped from a nearby nature strip and crushed his back fence. His Hills Hoist clothesline has been bent at a 90-degree angle and snapped.
A little bit of metal's hanging on, but other than that, that just shows how strong the wind is and how very precise and localised the wind was. So that's definitely shows tornado-type behaviour. Otherwise, the back of the house would be missing as well if this was a full-on cyclone.
Melbourne was also hit with heavy rainfall, 35 millimetres, making it the wettest day since April 2024. Adam's neighbour, Kerry, says it was a savage storm.
I was on my way home. My wife was here. My next-door neighbour's backyard finished in my driveway. So, pretty full on.
And there's a clean-up underway across southeast Queensland too, after thunderstorms brought severe winds and golf ball-sized hail. Brisbane resident John was out surveying the damage in his neighbourhood.
Trees down like this everywhere and people without power lines, and we've been talking to people and their internet's not working or internet's down. So, yeah, it's chaotic, just incredible. Haven't seen anything like this for a long time.
Thousands of people remain without power and there have been hundreds of calls to the state emergency service. And the heat is making things worse, with temperatures in the high 30s in Brisbane. There are also heat waves across northern Australia and what's been described as uncommon low snowfall in Hobart. Ellie Matthews is a meteorologist with the Weather Bureau.
Spring is quite a dynamic time of year and we do often see very variable weather conditions. That's just as the ocean temperatures around Tasmania are still relatively cool as we come out of winter, whilst temperatures do start to warm up over parts of the continent and even over Tasmania.
These latest storms come after extreme weather hit parts of the country last week, including storms in Melbourne and record-breaking temperatures across Queensland and New South Wales. While it might feel like weather's getting wilder and more unpredictable, it's not that simple. For example, Australia can see up to 80 tornadoes a year, though they usually don't hit populated areas, and there's no evidence to suggest we're seeing more of them. Miriam Bradbury is a senior meteorologist with the Weather Bureau.
Tornadoes develop extremely quickly and then they dissipate extremely quickly again, usually within the space of a couple of minutes, which is why they don't often make it onto warnings.
It's also not clear that climate change is causing more frequent or more serious hailstorms, but some of what we've seen in recent weeks is likely to be more severe because of the warming climate. Professor Andy Pittman is part of the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales.
So the easy one, the really clear one, are heat extremes, very hot days, intensification of heat waves, more frequent heat waves, and short duration rainfall occurring on timescales of 5 to 10 minutes is clearly intensifying.
Andy Pittman says Australia isn't investing enough in long-term climate-related forecasting, but we should be.
Australia is a third world country in its capacity to provide supercomputing and data at scale.
He says if Australia invested in its climate modelling, then we'd be more prepared for the future.
We would be able to predict the location of and frequency of many more of the extreme events that Australians suffer from, whether it be bushfire, drought, extreme storms, extreme winds, and so forth. We would have a better capacity to foreshadow how those things are going to change in our climate that continues to warm. We would have a better capability to identify where we needed to mitigate that risk. We might need to build flood defences, or we might need to future-proof property design and so forth. We would have a deeper understanding of where we needed to invest Australian taxpayers' dollars to build resilience in a changing climate.
That's climate change researcher Professor Andy Pittman, ending that report from Bridget Fitzgerald and Oliver Gordon. The ongoing war in Ukraine has seen European countries rushing to shore up their defences, and Australian companies have been capitalising on the new age of drone warfare. Eliza Getzey reports defence exports have increased dramatically.
So this is a facility here, and you see a drone approaching.
In a new age of warfare, software engineers are as crucial as any soldier. DroneShield CEO Oleg Vornik knows this. He's in the business of designing tools powered by artificial intelligence to fend off a weapon that's traditionally hard to detect.
And then once you've detected the drone, the next step is to defeat.
Including the drone gun, which doesn't use bullets but disorients a drone's signals to bring it down. This kind of technology is being used right now by Ukrainian soldiers to bring down Russian drones battering the country and other European countries, with recent incursions into peaceful countries, including Poland and Denmark, by drones linked to Russia. Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk says his country is the closest it's been to open conflict since World War II.
Unfortunate for humanity, but it's been a positive for DroneShield. We're seeing a huge amount of demand.
Investors have piled into Australian defence stocks like DroneShield, EOS and Austal in a year of turmoil across the globe. DroneShield is up more than 500% this year to date. Canberra-based laser company Electro-Optic Systems up 360%, and shipbuilder Austal, which supplies the US Navy, up 140%. Giuliano Salatena is a senior analyst with Bell Potter. He says with US President Donald Trump pushing NATO members to dramatically boost their defence budgets, Australian defence companies see an opportunity in the modern era of battle, where a drone worth a few hundred dollars can kill people and destroy infrastructure worth millions.
I mean, Australia historically hasn't been a big producer of fighter jets or submarines or big missile systems. Okay, that's really been the world of the big boys. I think what we've got at the moment is we've got a couple of niche providers that are doing very well.
Electro-Optic Systems has sold one of its Canberra-made Apollo lasers to a European customer for $125 million. Its boss, Andreas Schwer, says being a relatively small player provides agility in a world where staying ahead of the enemy means inventing new software every few weeks.
You don't need to be a multi-billion dollar conglomerate to have a decisive weight in this kind of new warfare scenario.
Defence Minister Richard Marles acknowledges a shift as Australia rises to meet European demand.
As strong as our relationship is with the United States, and I genuinely believe it's never been stronger, it would also be true to say that there are a whole lot of newer relationships with European countries, which are fantastic, to be honest, for Australia's national interest.
And demand is also heating up for more traditional military manufacturers in Australia, from Bushmasters on the front line in Ukraine to Austal ships built for the US Navy. European arms manufacturer Kongsberg is selling its Adelaide-made missile launchers to Denmark and Spain, and it's building Australia's first guided weapons factory, helped by federal procurement deals. John Fry heads its Australian arm.
You know, supply chains can be vulnerable, and you don't really want to have all your eggs in one basket in terms of supplies.
Companies like EOS and DroneShield have overseas outposts, but they've chosen to keep the brains of the operation in Australia.
You have this great engineering talent, but at the same time, you're not competing with shiny companies like SpaceX and Tesla and so on. So it's a great place to capture the talent.
EOS was started by a former leader of Australia's space program, Dr. Ben Green, and it also sells tools that track objects like satellites. Andreas Schwer says the company's origins point to the future.
Any future war will be decided in space. I think that is undisputed among militaries.
In the same month as we've seen a shaky peace agreement in the Middle East, Donald Trump abruptly cancelling his plans to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and Russian drones are continuing their assault, killing three people overnight in Kyiv. Analysts say the need for defence technology won't let up anytime soon.
No politician in any of those nations wants to be sit there in a year or 5 years' time and say, we didn't do enough to protect our population, we didn't do enough to protect our country.
A humanitarian nightmare for many that's become a winning investment for some.
That's Eliza Getzey reporting. This is PM, I'm Annie Guest. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, 300,000 Australians eligible for compensation from Facebook. Let's head to Africa now, where the civil war in Sudan has reached a dramatic turning point. The rebel militia, known as the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, says it's seized the city of El Fasher in North Darfur, which has been the Sudanese army's last remaining foothold in the region. It comes amid the war's growing toll of more than 150,000 killed and 12 million people displaced. The United Nations describes it as the world's largest humanitarian crisis. Diana Damjanovic reports.
Paramilitary soldiers wave their machine guns in the air in celebration, their faces beaming. They claim to have just taken control of the last government-controlled city of Darfur. Tears stream down the face of this soldier from the group, which is called the Rapid Support Forces.
God willing, we ask God to accept our martyrs.
The Rapid Support Forces' control of El Fasher is yet to be confirmed by the Sudanese government, but if it holds, it'll mean the group is able to consolidate its control over the vast Darfur region and embolden it to base its new alternative government there.
I seek refuge in God from Satan the accused. Today is an historic day. Today is an historic day. Today we raise the flag of freedom. Today we raise the flag of freedom. We've done the salute, sir.
Civil war between the Sudanese Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, has been raging in Sudan since 2021. The RSF has surrounded El Fasher for the last 18 months, frequently bombing army positions and civilians. An estimated 300,000 people have been trapped by the fighting in El Fasher. Sara Sanada is a Sudanese-Australian humanitarian specialist. She says earthen walls have been constructed around the city by the RSF, aimed at trapping the population in, and aid groups and the media can't get in.
We're getting announcements from the Rapid Support Forces militias saying that they have now taken over El Fasher. And we're also seeing statements being made by the neighbourhood committees in El Fasher, community groups and resistance groups, all saying that El Fasher has not actually been captured and it has not been taken over by RSF. So to be honest, as a Sudanese person, I'm not really clear about whether it's fallen or not. But what I know for sure, reports from Darfur have said over and over again, and particularly El Fasher, people are hungry, they're being starved. They're not starving, they are being starved.
The origins of this civil war in Sudan come down to a brutal struggle for power between two former allies. Abdel al-Fattah al-Burhan is an army general from the military elite who has been the de facto leader of Sudan since 2019. He leads the armed forces. And Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, nicknamed Hamadi, who is the head of the Rapid Support Forces and is originally from Darfur. Sara Sanada says there is significant interest in El Fasher in North Darfur.
It's very difficult, of course, for me to say this without a thorough investigation that's done by a neutral and impartial body. But we all know that El Fasher in West Sudan is one of the richest parts of the nation. It's very rich in natural resources. That could largely be the reason there's huge interest in it.
There are also concerns that this civil war in Sudan has become a proxy war involving outside powers.
There's a lot of reports coming out of credible sources, including Amnesty International and others, that have raised concerns about the flow of weapons and logistical support to armed actors through regional channels, including likely re-exports from the UAE via Chad. And these allegations need to be investigated thoroughly to be able to make this claim, but there is a lot of very likely strong evidence that points toward geopolitical interests in Sudan fueling the ongoing war.
And while all of this is happening, the humanitarian crisis gripping Sudan is the worst in the world.
Diana Damjanovic reporting. If you had a Facebook account 10 years ago, you might want to pay attention to this next story. For about 300,000 Australians, the social media site helped share a lot more than photos in what became a worldwide illegal data harvesting operation. The Privacy Commissioner is now urging users to check if they're eligible for compensation. Isabel Massali reports.
Social media site Facebook has long been used for sharing photos and life updates with loved ones. But in 2013, novelty personality quizzes were also taking over feeds. Here's what happened with one app called This Is Your Digital Life.
People think, oh, how interesting, I'll see how I score on this quiz. But it was, in fact, collecting that personal data to use for political profiling.
Catherine Kemp is an associate professor in law and justice at the University of New South Wales.
And ultimately, for instance, used in the States to aid in the election of President Trump the first time round, and used in other political campaigns. So one of the big problems here was that there were allegations that Meta, as the owner of Facebook, did not take reasonable steps to secure those users' personal data against that misuse.
This was known as the Cambridge Analytica scandal. In Australia, only 53 people directly used that quiz app. But the number of people affected is about 300,000.
This was part of the really unusual nature of the data breach, was it spread the net far wider because it also allowed Cambridge Analytica to access the data of all of those people's Facebook friends.
Australia's Privacy Commissioner, Carly Kine, says it was clearly against the law.
So everything from your profile pictures to your, you know, political affiliations, names, religion, etc., anything that was on a Facebook profile was shared. And you might recall that early in the days of Facebook, people were sharing a lot more information and a lot more sensitive and vulnerable information, including, for example, whether you were in a relationship or affiliated with a political party, etc. So all of that information was hoovered up through this scheme.
The Information Commissioner took Facebook's parent company, Meta, to court. And last year, they agreed to a landmark $50 million compensation scheme. But to be eligible, you have to submit a claim by December 31 this year.
You can just see if you're eligible by going to facebookpaymentprogram.com.au. You can check with the independent administrator whether you are eligible, but you may have also received a notification within the Facebook app, as Meta was also notifying potentially eligible users.
There are two different categories.
The first class, which is really the kind of lower threshold to clear, is simply that their data was affected by the scheme, that they experienced loss or damage as a result, and that can include generalized concern about their personal information. The second class is a higher threshold, and really is where you have to demonstrate some kind of tangible loss or damage, including economic loss. So, for example, you knew that your data was hoovered up by the scheme, and you became very anxious and concerned about that, so you sought counselling, for example, you could claim compensation for the costs incurred.
Privacy Commissioner Carly Kine says it's difficult to know how many people fall into that higher class.
We see, and not speaking about this particular incident, but we see relatively regularly, for example, survivors of domestic violence whose information is caught up in a data breach and published on the dark web, becoming highly upset and anxious about that fact, sometimes having to incur costs such as moving house, for example, because they're concerned about their location being available on the internet.
As for how much money claimants can expect, well, that's yet to be revealed. Graham Greenleaf says how this unfolded in the United States could give a clue. He's an honorary professor at Macquarie University's Law School and a board member for the Australian Privacy Foundation.
In that case, the claimants ended up getting $30 a head. But they don't have privacy laws like we do too. The situation may well be quite different here.
Any funds remaining in the $50 million scheme will go to an Australian government fund. Meta has been contacted for comment.
Isabel Massali reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Annie Guest. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. ABC journalist Adele Ferguson has spent months exploring Australia's childcare industry, and her findings have been simply devastating. Today, Adele, on her latest Four Corners investigation into how paedophiles are infiltrating childcare centres and why it's so much worse than we ever thought. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.